was never able to keep them straight. I've known colleagues and friends and members who can tell you exactly every event and which mission that it fell into. I'm talking about Paul, from his conversion on the way to Damascus till the time he died as a martyr for the gospel of Jesus. It appears he had four distinct missionary journeys. This one was his last one. In Acts 21, he's arrested for preaching, basically. There are vague charges. Certain Jewish men from Asia, they heard him preach. And in this political, religious, civil mess, he's nearly beaten to death. And he avoids being lynched. And there are other trials between two tribunals and two Roman governors and a king and the Sanhedrin and the high priests, all going over a period, way over a period of 2 years. When it's all said and he finally has his last appeal to Governor Festus of Rome and to King Agrippa of Judea, Agrippa leans over to Festus and said, this man could have been set free if he had not appealed to the emperor. See, the Romans will give him his due process as a citizen. We find out in these chapters, 23 to 27, that Paul is actually a Roman citizen. Very rare for a Jewish man in the first century. And he has rights. So it seemed to be a slick legal move to the religious leaders who are intent on just killing him. He actually found protection in Rome than he did from the Judean leaders, from the religious leaders of the day. And I thought that it was, as I said, a slick legal move to appeal as a Roman citizen. At least he'll get a trial. And he is given a trial. He will be given a hearing all the way to the emperor if that's what he wants. And that's what he did. He appealed to the emperor. But for Paul, it wasn't a legal move. Because the night that he was arrested, back in chapter 23, after being arrested in chapter 21, the night the Lord stood near him and said, keep your courage up, for just as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, you must also bear witness for me in Rome. Jesus told him that he would testify in Rome. So he's kept in Caesarea by the sea for nearly 2 years, as I said, in order to be able to get all of the legal meetings and testimony and everything out of the way. And after 2 years, he's finally headed to Rome by ship. And it's quite a journey. A centurion named Julius, in charge of the Augustan cohort. It's not the whole cohort that travels with him. That would be up to 600 soldiers. But it does appear to be quite a few soldiers, because they're going to be taking not just Paul, but other prisoners to Rome. And it sounds like they don't really have ships of their own, but what they do is that they contract themselves to cargo ships that are on the way. So that was Julius's job. Just as a note aside, when Luke describes this voyage, it sounds like he's an expert. If you read in Acts 27, everywhere that they went, I'm assuming that he has a background in it, but he's telling captains and mates, Paul is, what to do, and he knows, and Luke knows the weather, and he knows the seasons, and he knows the names and the nicknames of the winds and everything, and he knows the ports in which they're setting. It's amazing to listen to Luke describe this. They get about midway, if you look at a map across the Mediterranean, from Rome to Caesarea by the sea. You go about halfway, and then you begin to head up into the Adriatic from the Mediterranean. And they get about halfway at a place called Lycia. The centurion then puts them on an Egyptian ship, an Alexandrian ship that's headed for Italy. And they get out to sea, and they are just fighting winds right and left. And they're going so slow. And it sounds like they didn't beat the clock for this voyage. Verse 9 in Acts 27 says, since much time had been lost and sailing was now dangerous because even the fast had already gone by. The fast he's talking about is Yom Kippur. You don't sail in the Mediterranean or the Adriatic in winter. And that's already passed, and winter is already on them, and the winds and the storms that winter is bringing are just battering these ships. They're not going to make it. Because Paul advised them, he said, "Men, I see the voyage will be with danger and much heavy loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives." He's saying this trip is ill-advised. Julius listens to the captain and the ship owner, though. What is the ship owner going to do if you give him a choice? He's got to make his deliveries. He's got cargo. He's got to go. So, of course, the ship owner is going to say, "Let's go." So they keep going. And the winter winds are pounding them, and there are barely any islands. What I assume, I don't know much about sailing, but what you try to do if you're being battered by a wind is that you try to get on the other side of an island that'll kind of buffer that wind, and it'll move you along. Well, there are no islands left. Paul said there was just this one little tiny island that was left, and it didn't give us any buffer. So much so that they start throwing cargo overboard to lighten the ship. 3 days later, they're throwing the ship's tackle overboard. That's not fishing tackle. That's the riggings for the sails and everything else. They're just throwing it overboard. The ship is starting to come apart, so they're running ropes underneath the bow, and they're trying to hold it together. They're tying it all together. And verse 20 says, "When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest raged, all hope of our being saved was at last abandoned." All hope was abandoned. But then Paul remarkably gives them hope after a bit of Paul being Paul. This is what I love about Paul, is that no matter what situation Paul is in, Paul is still Paul. And he said this, he says, "Since they had been without food for a long time, Paul then stood up among them and said, 'Men, you should have listened to me and have not set sail for Crete, and therefore avoiding all of this damage and loss.'" I love when Paul's Paul. "I'm going to give you hope, but I'm also going to give you just a little bit of 'I told you so.'" But Paul's real. Paul is a believer, and that belief in him is real. So he says, "I urge you now to keep up your courage, for there'll be no loss of life among you, only of the ship. For last night there stood by me an angel of God whom I belong, and whom I worship. And he said, 'Don't be afraid, Paul. You must stand before the emperor, and indeed God has granted safety to all those who are sailing with you.'" God comes to Paul when all hope is gone, and the angel tells him, "I want to tell you again. I want to remind you of your mission. God says he will do this. Paul has to get to Rome. And since Paul gets to go to Rome, everyone else on the ship gets to be safe too. So keep up your courage, men," Paul says, "for I have faith in God that it will be exactly as I have been told." He tells them then that we'll probably get somewhere where we're going to have to run this ship aground. We got to get out of this. Otherwise, we're going to drown. So as soon as we're at land, we're going to have to run this ship aground. And he said, "We'll only lose the ship. We'll only lose the cargo. We will not lose a life." 14 days they are. 14 days without food. They're just battling this storm for 14 days. And they say that it's getting shallower. They're taking soundings and they can tell it's getting shallower. But they're afraid. The sailors are saying, "We're going to be smashed on the rocks." So they throw all four anchors out and they just prayed for daylight, every one of them. The crew starts to panic and they start heading for the lifeboats. Paul yells out to them. He says, "Stay with the ship. Tell them they've got to stay with the ship or they will not survive." As soon as he says that, they cut the lifeboats away. They cut them off. They send them to the bottom of the sea. So I picture the ocean is boiling. The ship is falling apart. And in all of that, it said just before daybreak, it's not even light yet, just before daybreak, Paul urged all of them to take some food. Paul comes out from the dark and he looks at all the men and he says, "Guys, let's eat." Imagine how it's been for 14 days. If they haven't eaten for 14 days, it's because they've been trying to save their own lives. Everyone has work to do. Everyone, all hands are on deck trying to save the ship, trying to save their lives. They've been fighting this for 14 days. Paul says that get us to land and everything's going to be okay. Let's go. Let's do it. We don't have time to what? We don't have time to eat. But Paul says, I urge you, take some food. It'll help you survive, for none of you will lose a hair on your heads. I just picture him standing there saying, let's eat. And if you're thinking that he's just going to throw some rations or some crackers at them so that they can, you know, munch on it while they're working and everything. No, that's not what he's saying at all. He wants them to stop their fight for survival. See, Paul doesn't say it, but he knows that their efforts, what they're doing, what they've been fighting for 14 days, that's not why they're going to survive. So Paul says, stop. Stop trying to fight your way to survive. And come here and let's eat. Like I said, he's not going to give them snacks that they can put in their pockets. He's not going to give them little cheese sticks and stuff that they could pull out while they're working. No, it says, after he had said this, he took bread and giving thanks to God in the presence of all, he broke it and began to eat. Now, if that language sounds eerily familiar, if the language and the pace and the cadence of that blessing sounds eerily familiar, you've heard it many times before. The first time back in Matthew when Jesus institutes this table that we're sitting at, when he sets this table that we're sitting at today, it said, while they were eating, Jesus took some bread and after a blessing, he broke it and gave it to the disciples and said, take, eat, this is my body. Paul does exactly with the bread to survive that night that Jesus does with the bread that we take communion with. And he says the same words and he pronounces the same blessing. And it requires you to stop. It requires you to stand. It requires you to break the bread and to hold it up and to say a formal blessing upon the bread. Paul gathers all of them around and performs this traditional Jewish formal blessing, blessing and breaking. They're not on the deck having Paul throw them some bread or throw them some wine, some cheese, or some fruit. They're standing around Paul as he pronounces this blessing, sounding exactly like his Lord sounds. Guess what happened? The very next verse, it says, then all of them were encouraged and took food for themselves. The thing that got them encouraged and brought them hope was when Paul takes them off the deck and says, quit fighting. God's got this. Let's eat. It's the sharing. It's the stopping. It's everyone being at the table. Roman soldiers, Egyptian sailors, Jewish prisoners, all of them, everybody at the table. And then Luke says this, he puts it, you have it in parentheses because he puts it along with verse 36. Verse 36 said, they were all of them encouraged and took food for themselves. We were in all 276 persons on this ship. There's nearly 300 people standing around getting this bread. And then he says this, he says, and after they had satisfied their hunger, they lightened the ship by throwing the wheat into the sea. 300 people ate that bread, and they all ate to what? Till they were full. What does that sound like? One day Jesus came across 5,000 hungry people and a couple of loaves of bread and a couple of fish. And he says, one blessing, and he broke the bread and blessed them, and everybody ate till they were what? Till they were full. Nearly 300 people ate on the ship that day. And by the way, if they threw the wheat into the sea after they had eaten, How did Paul make the bread? We do know what just happened right there, don't we? No wonder they were encouraged. So Paul was able to set that table in the midst of the storm that day. I believe, because he'd already been at this table. He'd already been to the table that the Lord had set for him. He'd already been given faith and hope and baptism in the Holy Spirit that allowed him to go out and to possibly perform an absolute miracle to be able to feed these men that day. I'm amazed at his grace in this story. I kidded you a little bit when he said, "I told you so," but that was only kidding. Paul's grace, what he's able to do, how he's able to give this out, none of what it takes for a ship to survive is used. He tells everybody, quit doing all that. What's important is that you gather around the table with me and Jesus. And with a few words and one single loaf of bread, watch what he'll do for you. Because it does conclude. After that, they threw the wheat into the sea, and they said immediately when they did that, they looked and there was an island that they were able to run aground on. They spend a few days on that island, and then they make their way to the peninsula, and they go all the way to Rome. But Paul makes sure that everyone, soldier, crew, prisoners, are not left out. If you want to spiritualize this, these are pagans, these are Jews, these are born-again Christian Jews, Paul and Andronicus that belong to the way. They all come around this table. Everybody is welcome at this table. Paul says, this miracle isn't just for us who believe. This miracle's for you. It's for all of us. How many people want to hold on to the blessing and say, you know what, a pagan wouldn't understand this. A pagan doesn't get this. Non-believers don't get this. It's amazing. The grace that Paul shows that all of them that day. It's been hard the past 4 years, has it not? I'm not sure about you, but it's the four hardest years I've ever been through in my life. And we've had to fight to survive. We've had to fight to figure out what was what. We have to fight every day now to figure out what normal looks like. Every day we seem to have nothing but unprecedented events. By the way, nothing is unprecedented. Paul, Solomon told us there's nothing new under the sun. It's just that we forget how hard life can be. But it seems to have gone out of its way the past 5 years to remind us, right? And the one thing that would be easy to do would be to forget to eat. It would be real easy to say, you know what, it's just too hard. Like, you know, this takes time and it takes effort and we may not have all the help that we need and everything else. And yet we're called to have communion in the midst of the war. It would be easy for us to forget to eat. Is it worth it to set this table every quarter again? I have to tell you, we're having it in the first Sabbath in August because I forgot. I was at camp meeting. How come y'all didn't remind me? But it is easy to forget, isn't it? I was at a church where we forgot for nearly a year. Somebody just happened to mention one day, hey, when was the last time we had communion? Is it worth it still? Is the effort worth it? Is it worth it to spend our Sabbath like this? Because it does interrupt our normal, regular, everyday, every 7 day Sabbath worship, doesn't it? It's not like it. It would be easy to say that it isn't worth it. Yad Vashem, the Jewish Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem, had a display. I'm not sure if they still do in all the remodeling, but they used to have a display of all the worship objects that they found in the camp. that prisoners that were dying, being starved and raped and beaten, had still found a way to be able to make worship objects out of what they had. The ones that I always remember is they had about an entire shelf of menorahs that were made out of bullet casings. Sabbath menorahs and Hanukkah menorahs, all made out of bullet casings. And you'd think, wow, in all of that, was it still worth it to worship? Can we still remember in unimaginable suffering that we're called to eat? See, communion already had a lot of momentum against us as Adventists. It's still the least attended Sabbath in all the North American church, communion Sabbath. We have less people attending than any other Sabbath. Because I know generations of us were more worried. We got more worried somewhere back a couple of generations ago of partaking of communion in an unworthy manner. We got so worried about that we ended up driving people away from coming at all. I remember that I was told that in school. So my first church, what I did was we had communion without announcing it. I thought, hey, if people aren't coming because they know it's communion, then let's not let them know it's communion. They're not going to turn around and walk out, are they? And then I was told why, that we had to get ready, that we had to be prepared. And it sounded to me kind of like we need to become good. We need to be better on communion than we do any other Sabbath. We need time to clean our act and get our act together before we take communion. Generations of doing that, we drove people away from the table. When actually, it's when our act is least together. It's when our life is unmanageable and can't be imagined. It's when we feel the farthest away from God is when we need communion the most. Because that cleansing, that getting your act together, that being right with God, that doesn't happen before you come to the table. It happens when you come to the table. That's why we're here. There was one time, I remember this woman who had been attending and everything, and she said, "Happy Sabbath" to me, and we walked into the church, and she looked up, and she saw that it was communion, and she leaned over, and she said, "I am absolutely in no shape to take communion today." She turned around and walked out. Happens at this table is for everyone who believes. Just like it was for everybody on the ship that day. The only unworthy ones are the ones that think that they're worthy before they get here. The only unworthy are the ones that think that they can make themselves worthy and prepare themselves for communion. I will say this, in Acts there's no distinguishing when you see breaking of bread. In the language itself, there's no distinguishing between the breaking of bread for communion and for dinner. Okay, there is no distinguishing. You have to know the context. You look at the context. And I know that this shipwreck meal isn't technically a communion. It's dinner. And it's a vital dinner. But I would argue that to Paul there was no difference between the two. To Paul, he performed the same blessing that he did for communion. He performed that same blessing for bread at dinner. For Paul, communion was life. And he wasn't going to let this go. He wasn't going to give this situation, their very survival, over to anything else but the breaking of the bread. This is my body. For Paul, blessing is for this life as we eat dinner, and blessing for eternal life as we eat at communion. Supper is supper, and they're both the Lord's. We all belong at the dinner table in the midst of our shipwreck. Jesus makes sure that we all belong at this table. He was broken, and his blood was shed to make sure of it, to make sure all of us could be here today. The cup of blessing that we bless, is it not a sharing in the blood of Christ? The bread that we break, is it not a sharing in the body of Christ? Because there's one bread. We who are many are one body, and we all partake. Welcome to the table set by Jesus.